Hi guys, here's my morning routine. First, I drink olive oil, like a lot of it. That's good. Next, I take an ice bath.
Ooh, feeling super healthy. Can't fit my toes.
Breakfast is raw liver.
Okay, here we go. Oh, real good.
If your health advice sounds strange coming from a kid, maybe it's just strange. Signos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time. Signos.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who pieced together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Corey Richens. We haven't talked about her in a little while, but it's probably time to do a little catch-up on Corey, because there's a lot of new things going on, including damn near 26 new felony charges that she is facing in relation to this case. So we'll take a little dive into this and get us up to date. The trial, by the way, not set until next year. It was a house of cards, fraud, motive, and the financial collapse before the murder that seems to set the tone for a lot of this case. The prosecution says this wasn't just a marriage falling apart. It was a financial collapse waiting to happen. Mortgage fraud, forged documents, a business bleeding money. We're going to dig into the sprawling white-collar charges that prosecutors say form the motive for the murder and whether they'd actually hold up in a courtroom. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, joining us to discuss all of this. So she's got these now new 26 felony charges, including mortgage fraud, forgery, money laundering, issuing bad checks, communications fraud, and engaging in a pattern of unlawful activity. None of it murder. But prosecutors say she owed $1.8 million in hard money loans at the time of Eric's death, with monthly debt servicing around $250,000. Or not monthly, that was what she owed at that moment in time, and tried to cash in on life insurance policies totaling $2 million. So maybe that was her ticket out. Eric, in your legal view, how strong is the state's claim that these financial crimes were the driving motive behind killing her husband?
Well, Tony, anytime you have a case where a partner's accused of killing their spouse, even though you don't have to prove motive, the jury's going to want to see it. They're going to want to know what is the reason why this person would have just offed their spouse in such a way, allegedly. And so I think this is the prosecution's attempt at really fortifying that motive element, that this was financial insecurity to the tune of seven figures plus, and that motivated Corey Richens ultimately to poison her husband, recoup the insurance money to try to pay off those debts that were skyrocketing as the months went by.
How easy is this to pass off to a jury? I mean, it does kind of, this is a scenario that plays into, if you're a true crimer, if you like Dateline, if you like true crime and all that sort of stuff, it follows that narrative where it's like, oh my gosh, there's this big financial motive. So I feel like it's an easy one, not super hard for a juror to digest this idea. But is that a good thing or a bad thing? Is that something where we hear so much of it, like in just the true crime world, of this sort of thing happening? I mean, does that kind of hinder judgment a little bit to think, oh yeah, well, if there's these signs of this, it must be that?
I mean, surely it's a common theme in cases like this. We saw it in the James Craig Colorado dentist poisoning murder case where they're saying they had a financial motive to do this. This is also a poisoning of one spouse case. You know, we got to be careful about not just having some sort of default motive to which we always resort, regardless of how strong that evidence is. And so here, you know, they're talking about these financial transactions, allegedly unauthorized, like embezzlement from the husband's company, that kind of thing. But the prosecution still has to, you know, come with it and bring the evidence to substantiate that. And if they can't, that would really undercut not only the financial crimes, but the murder charge.
Without a doubt. Obviously, from early on, maybe not obviously, if you're kind of new to the case and just starting to learn about it, Eric, her husband, was not super keen on this idea of this new property. This was a sprawling, large home that she wanted to invest in. And it was, to put it lightly, a fixer-upper. It was an unfinished home, a very large unfinished home that needed a lot of work to get done. And he said, you know, in no uncertain terms, I don't think so, honey. This doesn't look like a great investment for us. I don't think we should be doing this right now. You know, and probably also in the back of his mind thinking your company is failing. It really, anything you've been touching has not been working. Let's not do this. Let's not go bankrupt, honey. But I think he might have been trying to walk that fine line of staying married and maybe hoping her fun little activity that was draining the family. Maybe she'll find some other hobby. But it wasn't that. Prosecutors are claiming that she forged Eric's signature on a life insurance trust. I mean, how hard is it to prove a forgery was knowingly done to facilitate a homicide?
You know, there are several moving pieces to that. So to prove the forgery, sometimes they'll get a handwriting expert who will analyze Eric's and Corey's handwriting and say, hey, this is clearly not Eric's genuine handwriting. Someone else did this, and then try to tie it back to Corey. But also you got to think about in a marriage, sometimes when there are issues, there are, you know, financial transactions that happen. And sometimes, you know, one side might not be too keen on it, but they might acquiesce to it. And so simply because there are, you know, some financial suspicious moves being made, that doesn't necessarily mean there was a murder. And so I think that's how our defense might try to style this, is like, hey, this is sort of normal financial disagreements among a married couple that was going through some struggles.
What's the legal strategy here behind charging her both with the financial crimes and murder? I mean, we're kind of going a little a la Alec Murdaugh here, where, I mean, one doesn't always necessarily equate to the other. And does it help prove motive, or does it risk jury overload or even an appeal at the end of the day?
You know, jury overload, fatiguing those folks back there, is a legitimate concern. You know, I think that's part of why in the Diddy case, they really tried to streamline the charges. And still, I think the jury was overloaded with information that caused confusion back there. Always a risk that you got to think about. If proven, it certainly solidifies a financial motive. But the defense is kind of saying, hey, the prosecution's only doing this because they know their murder case is weak. And so they're trying to just kind of like bootstrap in these other scary sounding activities to make Corey look like a bad person. And so, yeah, I think the defense is going to say, hey, the murder case is weak. And that's the only reason these financial crimes are arising now, which is kind of in a late hour to be filed, as this case has been going on for several years.
Is the murder case weak? I mean, it feels like there's a lot there with this poisoning case. I mean, including just a lot of weird stuff from behind bars where she continues to incriminate herself after the fact, the whole wag the dog letter and all that. And if you're unfamiliar, in a nutshell, Corey was writing a book, quote unquote. It was more like a somewhat coded letter to her parents that talked about feeding the dog and saying this and saying that, and basically giving her bullshit alibi, allegedly, to her family. And go with this story, for lack of a better term. It doesn't look good. Again, doesn't necessarily prove murder. But again, is how strong is the case?
You know, there are a number of pieces of evidence that do not bode well for Corey Richens. You mentioned the letter that she wrote to her mom in sort of this coded, veiled language, but kind of instructing her, arguably, to help her kind of cover this whole thing up. On top of that, there were some searches, my understanding, such as what is a lethal dose of fentanyl? Eric mm-hmm. Richens died of fentanyl poisoning. Can cops uncover deleted messages? And these searches were from not her own phone, but a burner phone. So an added level of suspicion there. You know, not surprising that this artist, if we can call her that, is kind of saying, hey, no, the letter was just a work of fiction. I'm a writer, that kind of thing. And so the jury's going to have to sort of decide the genuineness of that representation.
Artist. She wasn't the one who did the artwork in her book, though. Someone else did that. She was just short of AI being able to do it. So she had to pay somebody. But yeah, I don't know what I'd even call this. Artist, con artist, maybe. That might be the one, too. I mean, alleged, you know. I mean, considering all the financial issues that she's also being charged with, I think that might be a fair assessment. The state seems to think that she might be one of those. Let's talk about the case a little bit more, not so much the financial end of it. I mean, how strong is the state evidence that this was a staged overdose and not an accidental one, as the defense claims?
Well, you know, one compelling piece of evidence for the state, I think, is that there was an alleged prior drugging, mm-hmm. that Corey Richens did this more than once. And in fact, the allegation is that she spiked Eric Richens's sandwich with fentanyl, which I don't even know how you do that. But if the jury accepts that, what that shows is a pattern of conduct, premeditation. It shows that Corey Richens is capable of drugging, that she knows how to do it, that she has access to the poisons in order to do that, and that she, in fact, tried to do it once before. And so if the jury accepts that as true, I think that's going to be really problematic for the defense.
How do you do that? Well, I got to tell you, I went into Subway just the other day, and not only do they toast the sub, they now offer fentanyl dust at the end to make that sub extra delicious. I passed. I said, I'm not into that. That's a little weird. That seems like kind of a strange upgrade to offer. It is a little pricey, but some people swear it really makes that chicken taste like chicken. So whatever you got to do.
Some of those Subways are getting rough out there.
Yeah. I mean, whatever you got to do, you got to eat fresh. And no, they're not offering fentanyl at Subway. If some tweaker is listening to this going, we got to go to Subway. No, it's a joke. How difficult is this going to be to prove the other attempted poisoning, though? I know that's the allegation. He's dead. He's not going to be around to really prove it. I wouldn't be surprised if she attempted to poison a sandwich with fentanyl. I imagine you just powder it out and you just kind of sprinkle it on there like salt. How do you prove that? I mean, it's a lot of hearsay. It's a lot of, you know, there's not exactly a toxicology on this one to say that it actually happened.
Exactly. And these poisoning cases are often circumstantial like that. And so it can be really difficult. You don't have, you know, some witness who was standing next to her while she's making the sandwich and sprinkling the fentanyl on allegedly. Mm-hmm. So you don't have that. You do have testimony about Eric Richens getting sick after eating that sandwich. In fact, I believe he even tells somebody, I think my wife drugged me. He takes this very long sleep, like an abnormal amount of time sleeping, and then comes back to life, thank heavens. But what is the jury going to infer from that? Certainly there are suspicious circumstances, but could that have, you know, be chalked up to some other kind of illness or some condition that Eric Richens had? Or if you're Corey Richens, she's essentially saying Eric Richens had a drug problem that was ongoing. And so it's going to be a little bit difficult to disprove some kind of drug problem in this case.
If he has the drug problem, why is she buying it for him? Why is she the one with the hookup? Why is she with the connection to the now deceased dealer? And let's talk about that aspect of it a little bit. She's got the connection. She's the one doing the dealing. She's the one doing the searches about dying on fentanyl, which I guess could be spun. And one would be she's a scared spouse. She is fearful that he's going to take too much. So she is making these searches. Just to see how much, if he took this, what could possibly happen? That's what's going on. That could be the argument. But let's talk about the dealer who is also dead now. How is that going to affect the strength of the state's case?
You know, that becomes a problem in these cases when witnesses die. It's an unfortunate reality of the court system. You know, not only do you not have Eric Richards, the victim, to testify about the alleged prior drugging and the ongoing financial issues and really the close internal dynamics of that relationship, but now you have the alleged supplier of the lethal dose of poison who is also not going to be testifying, who you can't cross-examine that person. And in fact, some of that person's prior statements are probably not coming into evidence because they're hearsay and it's not some kind of dying declaration or something. So, you know, little by little, the prosecution's case is sort of getting whittled down for no fault of their own. But these become real problems at the trial phase.
What do we know about the death of the dealer? I honestly don't know much about that angle of it. What do you know anything about what happened there?
I'm not aware of the precise details of it. Just that there are now at least two deaths in this ongoing saga with Corey Richens. Just it seems like, you know, people that she is around just happened to die. You know, I don't think there's any allegation that Corey Richens had something to do with that. But, you know, certainly adds a layer of mystery and intrigue and suspicion when you know, the person who would testify against you in a murder case turns up dead.
It's always interesting when that happens, isn't it? It seems, I mean, look, people die. Sometimes it just happens and it can be very inconvenient. But does raise an eyebrow, especially from someone who's writing jailhouse letters to others about the case and trying to get blocks to be in the pattern that she wants them to be in. So she doesn't get convicted. Let's talk about this angle of it. Those letters, 6-page handwritten letter, allegedly written from Corey to her mother, instructing her on how to walk the dog, which is an interesting choice of terms to begin with, and create testimony claiming that Eric himself had a drug problem. Prosecutors filed it publicly as evidence and attempted to get it in there as witness tampering. The defense argues it was a draft of a fictional book. we've talked about this a while back. A fictional book. Wasn't very long.
Like it sucks.
It would suck. I mean, but, you know, there's a lot of crappy books out there that, you know, I noticed that. I was thinking that the other day. I was in an antique store and there was a wall of books and a wall of movies. And I'm just like, look at all these books and all the time and effort that so many people put into each and every one of these. And how you look at them and go, I have no idea what this is. And nobody else does either. And no one else will ever see it. So I would imagine this book that she's writing probably would be in that pattern of ending up in an antique store within a couple months. That whole story of she's writing this book, is that one that you think they're going to take to the jury? Because, I mean, on its surface, it just looks like utter bullshit.
Sure. It's and, you know, when you're presenting arguments to a jury, you don't want to lose your own credibility.
No.
You know, the jury is looking to the lawyers on both sides and saying, hey, who can I trust? Can I really believe this person when they're telling me that this is the case? And so you got to think about that. And then we've seen this, too, in with rappers who have been charged. You know, they'll cite to music lyrics and the rapper said, oh, hey, that's just a song. That's just, you know, that's not reality. It's all fiction. And so it's kind of been a pretty common defense for artists and faux artists to utilize when they are accused of something like this and they have some kind of work that appears suspiciously to be tied to the allegations.
Yeah, she ain't no rapper. She's not penning hit 'em up or anything like that. It's not that. But hey, points for creativity, very much so. This is also something that could be looked at as consciousness of guilt. And how should a defense attorney respond to that? And how is the prosecution going to try and frame it?
You know, it was interesting. So it reminds me of the James Craig case, the Colorado dentist who poisoned his wife after he was incarcerated. He wrote several letters. His were soliciting the murder of a lead detective and trying to fabricate evidence in his own defense. And so how they styled it in that case, the defense, I thought, did a fine job of trying to explain it by saying, hey, he was a broken man at that time. He was desperate. He's in a box. He's facing a murder charge that he claims he didn't do. You know, he had to take desperate measures to try and protect himself. And I think that perhaps could be the way defense tries to explain it away in the Corey Richens case, just by saying, you know, she didn't know what else to do. She was wrongly accused. And what else do? You try to better your situation. You go to your mom and see what help you can get. So that might be the way defense looks at it. The way prosecution's going to look at it is saying, hey, this is consciousness of guilt. She knew that the end of the road was coming, and she had to commit more crimes in order to cover up the first one.
And that's when I look at that, it's following a pattern, because these narcissistic monsters out there, allegedly, if she is one, if she is the one that did this, they do the same shit, and they all think they're just as genius every time they do it. Oh, we're gonna do all these things to make it look like I'm this grieving person. This is so horrible. She wrote a book, but it's for the kids, to help them deal with grief. And look at me, I'm just this. I mean, that was her initial angle, and then you got this. You got the letters. To get everything else, and it's a ruse. It's always seemingly something to shift the blame, shift the angle somewhere else, rather than taking any sort of responsibility. And they seem to think that no one will be the wiser, no matter how absurd their claims and actions are. It's almost like they're completely tone deaf to what they're throwing out there, or blind to it. I mean, do you see that in individuals that kind of fit this sort of personality profile that we have now witnessed of Corey Richens?
I mean, absolutely. And oddly, I've seen it in multiple poisoning cases where the accused is just audacious, and they have this confidence, likely kind of a misplaced confidence, where they think they're untouchable. They can get away with anything. So they're the orchestrator behind the scene. They're smarter than everybody. They're going to be just fine. But when the light of day is shown upon these actions, you know, like you said, a layperson looks at that and says, gosh, that looks like you're trying to cover up the murder of your husband. It doesn't look like you're writing some ridiculous shitty book that happens to reference your mother or something. And they just don't see it. They don't get it.
Do you think that this should still stay in Summit County? Can they produce a fair jury in this case? I mean, nationally, this case has been silent for a little while because there just hasn't been a ton going on with it. But, locally, it's a big deal. A lot of people are paying very close attention to this. I mean, is a change of venue a better option in the interest of not having possible issues that could come up on appeal?
It very well could be. And one of the reasons is because, you know, this isn't some massive county. It's not Denver County where I practice. It's not New York or Los Angeles or something like that. Summit County is rather small. And so there is an increased concern that those folks have been sort of saturated with media coverage and perhaps have drawn conclusions of their own already. And so why not just avoid that risk by transferring it to some outside county? It's not a terribly difficult process. It's not, doesn't require a ton of legwork. It's really just, hey, now the case is in this county and we're going to proceed as we have been. That eliminates that risk. It seems like a safe bet.
It's delayed till 2026 now. I mean, let's talk about time on this. I mean, how do you feel that this could benefit or hurt either side?
Well, one kind of old adage is that delay is a friend of the defense. That's not how I see it, but that's how some defense practitioners see it. And look at this case alone. As time has gone by, the alleged drug supplier is now dead. You know, as time goes by, witnesses fall off. They move. They die. They change their minds. People's recollection begins to become eroded. Pieces of evidence become eroded. And so, I think Corey Richens, as uncomfortable as it might be waiting this out, it legally, it's in her best interest because things can go south. New prosecutors get on cases. There are all sorts of changes that could behoove the defense.
There's a lot of things that could certainly happen, including the possibility, like we saw in the Brian Koberger case, of a plea deal coming forward. It could be run out in that way as well. We could get really close to this, and it could look really damning, and it may be one of those come-to-Jesus moments where the attorney's like, you might want to take a plea. Should we go to them? Should we say, we'll do this? Or do you want to end up over here in prison for the rest of your life? Or, either way. Do you think we're going to see a plea deal at some point in this case? There is a lot of strong evidence. Or with this character here, the Corey Richens, the narcissist, she's far more like a James Craig, I think, than a Brian Koberger in terms of ego and misguided grit. Do you see a plea deal in the future here, or is this thing going to go to trial in 26?
Well, I can tell you, Tony, having those come to Jesus talks with your client as a defense attorney is tough. It can be uncomfortable, unpleasant at times, especially when you take into consideration sort of the personality of the client and the person accused of murder. Like you said, sometimes there's an ego involved. There can be this sort of misplaced confidence where they don't see it like you do. They don't see the legal reality of it. However, as we get closer and as the prosecution has piled on these charges, that gives the prosecution additional leverage. That puts the defense in a more compromising position and more likely to at least explore the possibility of a plea. And I think her attorneys would be remiss if they didn't at least consider it.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Want to try a free sample of berry pie?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait,
can something this small really throw my body off balance?
Time to consult the online experts.
One bite will destroy your metabolism. Drink butter coffee instead to kill cravings.
What? Is it really that bad? I had protein this morning, right? Ugh, but it looks so good.
Only eat after walking 10,000 steps.
Pie is only 2 steps from here. Am I overthinking again? Oh, the kids would really love this.
Fruit ruins insulin sensitivity.
Never eat after 7 p.m.
One cheat day.
Cut carbs. Fast for 48 hours.
Stop it!
They don't know your body. Only you do. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. No fads, no fear. Just your signal. Cygnos.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi there, my name is Annie Elise, aka your true crime BFF and host of the podcast Serialously. I have been a true crime enthusiast forever, but I wished somebody would break down the cases for me like a friend, giving all the details and discussing every twist and turn. So I decided to create a podcast that does just that. Serialously with Annie Elise is topping the charts with over 1 million weekly downloads. I do the deep dives in these cases so you don't have to, diving into all the raw details, saying what we're all thinking, and in a conversational way, just like having a conversation with your best friend. So join me and let's talk all things true crime. Serialously with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.